media to show us something about fame and its magic touch. So what if that touch is a punch? She's famous now. Maybe she's trying to get us thinking about the different ways people get famous. By excelling at something or by suffering publicly. Maybe what the eyewitness saw was a performance. What if she already had an agreement with Matyáš that he would beat her up for the concept? Doesn't it seem like there's no way to avoid getting punched by someone or other? Doesn't matter who you are, it's just a fact of life. So, isn't it a little better if you get to choose who punches you? You know, I think if I could pick, I would have chosen him too. She was doing well until Noor, who'd stopped me from countering every single one of her speculations, said, darling, would you? Then she buried her head in her dad's jumper and howled. We couldn't tell if it was heartbreak, rage, mirth, or simply the difficulty she was having, unimagining. Mr. Matyáš Fuchst. The rehabilitation of Matyáš Fuchst was in full swing. His compulsory course of therapy was over, but he was continuing of his own accord. His fiancée quietly moved back into his house, and he was doing a fuckload of charity work. The charity work was the last straw for me. Before I explain the part I may or may not have played in another man's complete mental and physical breakdown, I just have to quickly praise myself here. Yes, I have to be the one to do it. Nobody else even understood how patient I was with Aisha's mourning process in the midst of every other grief-worthy event going on in the world. Aisha herself was in a hurry to attain indifference to the Fuchst matter, but you can't rush these things. The cackling with which Aisha greeted YouTube woman's simple and dignified acceptance of Matyáš Fuchst's apology, that cackling was not ideal. Words were better, a little less opaque, so I was patient with her outbursts. More patient than Jesus himself. The first I knew of my contribution to the charity of Matyáš Fuchst's choice was an email that arrived while I was pursuing quotes from satisfied customers. The email thanked me for my £10,000 auction bid, the winning bid, and expressed hope that my daughter Aisha would enjoy the private concert that Matyáš Fuchst would accordingly perform for her. 10,000 of my strong and painstakingly saved pounds, Matyáš Fuchst. That was all I was able to compute. Oh, and I saw red arrows between the two. £10,000 to Matyáš Fuchst. I had some sort of interlude after that, running between my keyboard and the nearest wall, flapping my hands and choking. Taiki came into my office, glanced at my computer screen, threw a glass of water in my face, and left. That got me to sit back down, at least. 5 minutes later, Aisha Skyped me from a school computer lab. I accepted the call, put my face right up to the camera, and bellowed her name until she resorted to typing. OMG, please calm down. You've got to calm down. I'm cashing the voucher. I said I'm cashing the voucher! What voucher? I asked the camera. Aisha held up a finger, rummaged in a school bag, and held up a voucher I'd given her on her last birthday, the last of a booklet of six. There, in my own handwriting, were the words, "This voucher entitles you to one completely fair and wrath-free hearing." "Ah," I said, banging my chest, trying to open up some space in there. "Okay, okay, I'm ready." "I used your emergency debit card," Aisha said. "You know, Dad always wants to know why I'm like this, and all I can say is, I'm sorry I am, but I think, no, I'm sure that if I just look him in the eye, I know it's a lot of money. I didn't really think the bid would go through. I didn't know you had that much on there. But please understand, I will pay you back. I'm going to get a job, and I'm going to make some stuff and sell a lot of it." "It's okay," I said. "It's okay." My heartbeat was returning to normal. Aisha had been operating on the principle that I wouldn't want to be that guy who embarrasses himself by withdrawing a £10,000 donation he made to an enormously deserving cause. But I am that guy, so it's fine for me to do that. Noor's ex-wife came over for coffee and spoke of seeking psychiatric assistance for Aisha, particularly in the light of Dai's discovery that Aisha had made a purchase from her laptop, a liter of almost pure sulfuric acid, 96%. The three of us sat silently with our coffee cups, picturing Aisha and Fushd, alone in some garland-bedecked bower, Fushd singing his heart out, maybe even singing his latest hit, Dress Made of Needles. Then as the last notes of the song died out, Aisha uncapped the bottle of acid hidden beneath her dress and let fly. For about a week, Noor couldn't look at Aisha without shouting, "What are you?" All we'd hear from Aisha was the bitter laugh, and I tried to soothe her by saying, "He's been forgiven, Aish. Everyone else has forgiven him." But I stopped that because there was a look that replaced her laughter, and that look haunted me. It was Ked's opinion that it might have been all right if the apology had been something that Aisha could consider real. But now this thing wouldn't end unless she was able to take or witness vengeance upon Matyash Fushd. Taiki agreed, but with a slight modification. Aisha would be able to move on if Matyash Fushd was able to deliver a sincere apology for what he'd done. At least, that's how it would be for me, Taiki added, twirling her wedding ring around her finger. I mean, the galling thing about Dress Made of Needles is that as a piece of music it's fine, but as an apology it takes the piss. But you know what? At least we got a meaningful song out of it. At least he wrote this good song because of her. The constellation on Taiki's wrist was definitely a tattoo that day, and her breeziness was macabre. I thought for a long time, or what felt like a long time anyway, before I asked her if there was anything she could do for Aisha. "Let me talk to her," Taiki said. I wasn't allowed to listen to the conversation, but I know that it concerned the invocation of a goddess, and Taiki was very well prepared for it. Arrived at our house wearing an elegant black suit, and carrying a portfolio full of images and diagrams that she and Aisha pored over at length. "Just FYI, we decided on Hecate," Taiki said, on her way out.
"Yeah, who's she?"
"Oh, nobody you need to worry about. Come on, let me have the basics."
"Well, she keeps an eye on big journeys from the interior to the exterior, or vice versa. She's there for the step that takes you from one state to another. She's someone you see at crossroads, for instance. Well, you sort of see her, but don't register what you've seen until it's too late to go back. She holds three keys. Some say they're keys to the underworld, others that they're access to the past, present, and future, and... Ah, you're zoning out on me." Taiki struck and held a warlike pose in the doorway. "Picture the image of me fixed in this doorway, and also in every other doorway you pass. Sometimes three-dimensional and sometimes vaporous. Whatever I feel like being at the moment, you try to get past me," she said. "Imagine not being able to stop me from coming in. Imagine not being able to cast me out because I own all thresholds. As an additional bonus, imagine me with three faces. That's who we're sending to have a little chat with Matyash Fushd."
"Oh, why didn't you just lead with that instead of the benevolent stuff? But listen, hang on, Taiki, is that not a bit much?"
She was already gone. Summer has come back around, and with only a week until Ked returns from military service, I write this from a bench before Ked's water fountain at the House of Locks. The woman with the voice he likes came in while I was feeding Boudicca, so I left. Anyway, events of recent months presented without comment, for who am I to comment after all? The day after Taiki and Aisha had their meeting,
A black-bordered notice appeared in one of the national newspapers. Rest in peace, Maciej Fuszt. Happy birthday, Maciej Fuszt, and good luck. Your rebirth will be a difficult one. Naturally, a lot of questions were asked. Since Maciej Fuszt was alive and, at that time, well, it proved impossible to discover who was responsible for the notice. The day after the notice appeared, Maciej Fuszt phoned into a 5 p.m. radio show that was popular with commuters all over the country and announced that he'd like to apologize for his apology, which had come more from his head than his heart. He also asked that his fans cease the verbal abuse of the victim of his attack, since she had been through a lot and hadn't asked for a penny in compensation beyond their original transaction. The hosts of the radio show had to ask him to repeat his declarations of remorse several times because his weeping made them unintelligible. About a week after that, Fuszt interrupted his performance on the live taping of a variety show to state that he was being hounded and that he feared for his life, that they pricked him with needles and slammed his hands indoors. When members of the audience pointed out that he was uninjured, he appeared confused and said that it had only happened inside where no one could see. Before the broadcast was halted, he also managed to say that he believed in attacking the woman he'd met on the street. He'd been following a bad example set by his father, who'd frequently beaten his mother in front of him. His parents issued a joint denial that basically boiled down to, "We have no idea why he's saying these things, but it's making us sad." Fuszt's fiancée moved out of his house again with talk of plans to focus on her career. That was funny and rather sweet. If there was ever anybody born focused on her career, it was this prima ballerina. But her statement suggested she thought it didn't show. As for her ex-fiancé, a few close members of his family moved into his home to look after him. The close family members were unable to prevent him from phoning into radio shows and appearing on Breakfast TV to apologize for his previous apologies and make further apologies. He ended his most recent TV appearance with the reflection that quality was probably better than quantity and that he'd take his time to find a genuine expression of his thoughts. He'd been told that the key to a real apology was the identification of one's real mistake. He hoped to be able to do that soon. Healthcare professionals were reported to have joined the close family members surrounding Fuszt at his home, but he escaped them all and was reported missing for 6 months. Fuszt was found to have been sleeping rough all winter, a very hard winter, so much surprise was expressed that he'd lived through it. He gave one interview to a reputable chronicle of paranormal phenomena. I think he intended for the interview to dispel the rumours of his insanity, but it had the opposite effect, especially when he spoke about them. They demanded that he apologise, and then called his apologies glib. He said that they were three women, and yet they were one, and that one of them took his pain away so that the others could return it to him, and so it went on. He said he should have died during the winter, but it pleased them to keep him alive in order for him to learn what he could say or do to keep them off. If there was anybody who knew how to convince this woman that he was sorry, Maciej Fuszt begged to know that secret at any price.
Aisha may have abandoned tales for good, but all-heal plants are flowering in her window box. She's working on reducing the aphrodisiac effect of an otherwise very convenient headache cure, and she's looking forward to Maciej Fuszt's forthcoming book, An Outcast's Apology. She reckons Fuszt is getting closer to identifying his mistake, and says he should keep trying.
Is your blood as red as this? 1. No. You always said, Myrna Semyonova, that we weren't right for each other, and it always made my heart sink when you said that. But my answer was always, You're wrong. I'll show you. I'll show you. I've got something that other lovers would give a great deal to possess. A perfect memory of the very first time I saw you. I was 15, and my handsome, laconic 18-year-old brother burned brightest among my heroes. I followed him everywhere. Well, he sometimes managed to escape me, but most of the time he didn't make too much of an effort. That's Arjun's gift, never trying too hard, always doing just enough. Somehow he knew how to be with people, when to make eye contact and when to gaze thoughtfully into the distance, how to prove that you're paying attention to what you're being told. It was Jyoti's breaking up with him that improved his people skills. For 3 years, Jyoti had been warning him and warning him about his tendency not to listen to her or to anyone. "Don't you ever think that one day you might miss something really important, Arjun?" she'd say. "Something that someone can only say one time?" He tried to focus. Well, he claimed that he was trying, but he still tuned out. If Jyoti was talking, then he'd gaze adoringly at her, but not hear a word. And with everyone else, he'd just fall silent and then insert a generic comment into the space left for him to speak in. God knows where his mind used to go. One day, Jyoti met up with him at the cafe down the road for a make-or-break conversation. She had a favor to ask him, she said, and if he didn't at least consider doing it, then there was no point in their being together. "Jyoti, you have my full attention," he said immediately. "Tell me. I'm listening." 15 minutes later, she checked her watch, kissed him on the cheek, and left the cafe beaming. She was late to meet a friend, but he'd agreed to do her the big favor she'd asked for. Only, he had no idea what the favor was supposed to be. She'd lost him about 4 words in. He asked a woman sitting nearby if she'd overheard the conversation, and if she could by any chance tell him what had been asked of him. But the woman was elderly and said, "Sorry, love, I'm a bit hard of hearing nowadays." A couple on the other side of him categorically denied having heard anything, even after he told them the future of his relationship depended on it. This was England, after all, where minding one's own business is a form of civil religion. So all he could do was wait for Jyoti's furious, "I can't believe you!" phone call, and vow to win her love again one day, when he'd become a better man. I was learning a lot from Arjun, and I had lots more to learn. In those days, when anyone spoke to me, I became a flustered echo, scrambling up the words they'd said to me and then returning them as fast as I could. Blame it on growing pains or on the ghost I shared my bedroom with. Nana, before you, I could only really talk to my brother and the ghost. There was something disorganized about the way she spoke that rubbed off on me. Plus she, the ghost, had warned me that the minute I grew up, I wouldn't be able to see her anymore. How will I know when I've grown up? When I started using words I didn't really know the meaning of, she said. I said I did that already, and she said, but I worried about it and grown-ups didn't. Of course, I'm paraphrasing her. When I think back on her syntax, it's like hearing a song played backward. So then there's this trepidation that you're going to suddenly find yourself having a conversation that turns you into a grown-up, a conversation that stops you being able to see things and people that are actually there. My brother knew about the ghost, but described her as an alarmist, said I needed to get out more, and invited me to his friend Tim's 19th birthday party. The party where I met you, Myrna.
"You can be my date tonight if you like," Arjun said.
"Won't people think it's creepy?" I asked.
"Nah. If anything, females are into males who are nice to their verbally challenged little sisters," he said. "Gives the impression of having a caring side and stuff like that."
What a relief. I'd hate to come between you and the females.
"Don't even worry about that, Radha. That's never going to happen."
And so on. I know what it is to have a brother that people like talking to, so I brought a book just in case the evening took Arjun away from me. But he stuck with me, introduced me to the birthday boy, called upon his friends to observe the way I calmly matched him beer for beer, generally behaved in a way that made me feel as if I was something more than a stammering fly on the wall. Then a boy approached us. Well, Arjun, really. A nondescript sort of boy, I'm surprised to say, since his hair was green. He had a look of rehearsal on his face. He was silently practicing sentences he'd prepared, and Arjun said to me quietly, "Wonder what this one's after." The boy, Joe, was Tim's cousin.
"Joe who goes to the puppet school?"
Arjun asked.
"Yeah."
"Seen, seen," Arjun said.
"What you saying? Girls like you, don't they?"
Joe asked. Arjun lowered his eyelids and shrugged. If I'd been wearing sleeves, I'd have laughed into one of them. Joe had a 20-pound note, which he was willing to hand over to my brother right now if Arjun would go over to a certain girl, dance with her, talk to her, and appear to enjoy her company for a couple of hours. Once I realized what he was asking, I thought, even Arjun will be lost for words this time. But my brother must have had similar requests before. Can teenage boys really be so inhuman? Because he asked, "Is she really that Butters? I haven't seen any girl I rate below a 7 tonight. A good night, I was thinking." The boy had the good grace to blush.
"No, she's not that ugly. Just not my type."
"Why do you even bring her then, if she's not your type?" Arjun asked.
"It was a dare," Joe said miserably. "I don't usually do things like this. You can ask Tim. Just believe me when I say I didn't have much of a choice. I didn't think she'd say yes, but she did."
"Mate, don't pay people to hang out with her."
"I don't know what else to do. She's got to have a good time. She's my headmaster's daughter. I don't think she'd get me expelled or anything. Maybe she won't even say anything to him. But she's his daughter."
"Better safe than sorry," my brother agreed. "Myrna, by that point I was already looking around to see if I could spot you. What level of unattractiveness forces people to pay cash so as to be able to avoid having to look at it or speak to it? And when Joe said that he'd been trying to talk to you, but you just sat there reading your book, I searched all the harder."
"What kind of person brings a book to a party?"
Arjun said expressionlessly, without looking at me, but he gave me a little nod that I interpreted as a suggestion that I seek this girl out.
"What's her name?" I asked.
Joe told me. "I found you half buried in a beanbag, pretending to read that dense textbook that takes all the fun out of puppeteering, the one your father swears by. Bramboni's War Between the Fingers and the Thumb." Curse stuffy old Bramboni. Maybe his lessons are easier to digest when filtered through stubbornly unshed tears. You had a string of fairy lights wrapped around your neck. I sort of understood how that would be comforting, the lights around your neck. Sometimes I dream I'm falling. And it's not so much frightening as it is tedious, just falling and falling until I'm sick of it. But then a noose stops me short and I think, well, at least I'm not falling anymore. Clearly I hadn't arrived in your life a moment too soon. You looked at me, and this is how I saw you, when first I saw you. I saw your eyes like flint arrows, and your chin set against the world. And I saw the curve of your lips, which is so beautiful that it's almost illusory. Your eyes freeze a person, but then the flickering flame of your mouth beckons. Thank God Joe was so uncharacteristically panicky and stupid that evening. I discovered that I could talk to you in natural, complete sentences. It was simple. If I talked to you, perhaps you would kiss me, and I had to have a kiss from you. To have seen your lips and not ever kiss them would have been the ruin of me.
As for what you saw of me, I think you saw a kid in a gray dress gulping at you like you were the meaning of life. You immediately began talking to me as if I were a child at your knee. You told me about how stories come to our aid in times of need. You'd recently been on a flight from Prague, you told me, and the plane had gone through a terrifyingly long tunnel of turbulence up there in the clouds. Everyone on the plane was freaking out except the girl beside me, you said. She was just reading her book. Maybe a little bit faster than usual, but otherwise untroubled. I said to her, "Have you noticed that we might be about to crash?" And she said, "Yes, I did notice that, actually, which makes it even more important for me to know how this ends." I got you to dance, and I got you to show me a few of the exercises you did for hand flexibility. And I got you to talk about your school and its classrooms full of students obsessed with attaining mastery of puppets. I liked the sound of it.
Your eyes narrowed intently as you spoke of your final year there. The best two students were permitted to choose two new students and help them through their first year. It was in your mind to play a part in another puppeteer's future. That much was clear. You believed in the work that puppet play can do. You'd seen it with your own eyes. Before your father began teaching, back in the days when he performed, you had seen a rod puppet of his go down on its knees before a girl who sat a little aside from his audience of schoolchildren. This girl had been looking on with her hair hanging over her face, only partly hiding a cruel-looking scar. Her eyes shone with hatred. Not necessarily hatred of your father, or of puppets or the other children, but a hatred of make-believe, which did not heal, but was only useful to the people who needed it. Man and long-bearded puppet left the stage, walked over to the girl, and knelt. The puppet's kneeling was, of course, guided by your father's hand, and every eye in the audience was on your father's face. But his uncertain expression convinced everyone that the puppet had suddenly expressed a will of its own. "Princess, I am Merlin. You're Merlin," the puppet man said to the girl. "At your service forever." "Me?" the girl said, suspicious, on the edge of wrath. "You just try and make me the butt of your joke." "Me? A princess? You at my service?"
"It's no mistake."
The puppet's hand moved slowly, reverently. It held its breath despite having no breath to hold. The girl allowed that wooden hand to fondly brush her cheek. Watching, you were absolutely sure that no hand of flesh and bone would have been allowed to come that close.
"This is the sign by which we recognize you," the puppet said. "But if you wish, you may continue as you are in disguise."
And your father and his puppet returned to the stage, never turning their backs on the girl, as is the protocol regarding walking away from royalty. The girl's teacher cried, but the girl herself just looked as if she was thinking. She continued to think through the second act of the puppet play, but by the third act she was clapping and laughing as loudly as the rest of them. "I really don't know why I thought your reaching the end of the story would be a good moment to kiss you. I wasn't entirely surprised that it didn't work." "Young lady, I'm flattered and tempted, but how old are you anyway?" you asked. "Then you said I was too young. Too young, not right for you, blah, blah, blah. Always something." Joe and Arjun appeared with our coats, and you slid my book out of my coat pocket.
"What's this?"
Fate is what it was. Yes, fate that the book I had with me was a novel written by my great-grandfather, a text you couldn't read because my great-grandfather had put a permanent ban on any of his works being translated into English, Russian, or French. He was adamant that these three are languages that break all the bones of any work translated into them. Since people like getting around rules, there are various unofficial translations of my great-grandfather's books floating around online, but all of them just seem to prove his point.
"Just tell me the beginning of it, then," you said, and I opened the book to translate for you. You liked the beginning. A woman opens her front door to find a corpse on her doorstep. But before the body can topple across the threshold of her home, she says, "Oh, no, you don't," pushes it back out with a broom, and legs it out of the back door.
"Wait," you were saying, as I walked away arm in arm with my brother.
"Hang on, Rodda, I need to know."
"I'd say she's at least an 8, my brother said, surprised.
You have my permission to make him regret marking girls' physical appearance out of 10.
When I got home, the ghost immediately knew something was up. She said she'd been wondering when I'd meet someone. "If I don't know, if some sort of miracle happens and I have sex with someone, will I stop being able to see you?"
The ghost looked crafty for a moment, then relented and said no, I was stuck with her. And she was pleased for me when you phoned me the next day to ask me to translate the next paragraph of my great-grandfather's book. You hung up as soon as I gave you the paragraph, but the ghost said you'd come back for more, and you did. You began to talk to me a little after each day's translation, asking me questions about myself and my day, and whatever music happened to be playing in my bedroom whenever you called. "Glad you like it. I don't know what this song is called, but it's probably quite a bit older than we are.
The truth is, we've got a nostalgic ghost for a DJ around here, I'd say. And you'd laugh, thinking I'd made a joke. The ghost observed that I was going to come to the end of my translation one day. Yeah, but come on. We're only halfway through the second chapter, and after this book there are 15 others by the same author. The ghost asked if I thought my great-grandfather would be impressed by this use of his hard work. Oh, ghost, what have you got against love? Nothing, said the ghost, sounding injured. She had nothing whatsoever against love. She was just saying. The ghost showed that she was on my side. When she heard you mention the news that you were one of the two final year students who got to select a newcomer to mentor. It's going to be fun. We get to watch the applicants through hidden panels in a soundproofed room so they don't hear us booing or cheering them. This terrified me, but the ghost breathed on the windowpane and wrote, "Forgo it," on the misted glass. "Who's the other student?" I asked. "Not green-haired Joe." Ha-ha, no, though he does put on interesting Punch and Judy shows. Dad says he's going to be very good one day. The other student's a boy called Gustave Grimaldi. I don't like the way he performs. It's scruffy, and I'd say his puppets have a nihilistic spirit, if you'd understand what I meant by that. Nihilistic? Sounds bad, I said, pinning the phone to my ear with my shoulder as I googled nihilistic. Sometimes his puppets won't perform at all. He just lets them sit there, watching us. Then he has them look at each other, and then back at us until he feels as if they have information. Some kind of dreadful information about each and every one of us, and you begin to wish they'd decide to keep their mouths shut forever. There's no entertainment in it at all, and I don't understand why he chooses this way to put on a show when he knows so many other ways. He shouldn't be allowed to choose any new students. If there's anyone bound to introduce unsavory elements into our group, it's Grimaldi. Good thing I'm extra wholesome, then. Do applicants have to have experience with puppets and all that? I asked. And when you said that, in fact, your father liked people to come to the field fresh, I asked if 15 was too old to start. Not if you're serious. Are you? As serious as I can be, I don't feel 100% sure that I'm not a puppet myself, I said. No wonder I like you, you said. The ghost gave me a high five. You need a puppet, you went on. Competition for places is quite fierce. People do what they can to stand out. Some people make their own puppets. I did, out of paper and pins. The thing fell apart mid-performance, but I built that into the story. Mum and Dad wouldn't be thrilled by my new career ambitions. Don't forget your Uncle Modgy. Modgy the Mime. And ask yourself, do we really want more people like that in our family? My parents worked a lot. No need to bother them with something that might not work out. The thing to do was gain admission first and talk them round later. I bought a brown-skinned glove puppet. He came with a little black briefcase, and his hair was parted exactly down the middle. The precision of his parting made me uneasy. Somehow it was too human, at the exact same time as exposing his status as a non-human. I got him a top hat so I wouldn't have to think about the cloth hair falling away from the center of his cloth scalp. You gave me a hand with some basics of ventriloquism, even though you definitely weren't supposed to help. It was then that I began to hope that you'd stop saying I wasn't right for you. And I taught my puppet to tell jokes with a pained and forlorn air, fully aware of how bad the jokes were. Sometimes you laughed, and then my glove puppet would weep piteously. When you took the glove puppet, he alternated between flirtatious and suicidal, hell-bent on flinging himself from great heights and out of windows. I noticed that you didn't make a voice or a history for the puppet, but you became its voice and history. I'd have liked to admire that, but felt I was watching a distressing form of theft, since the puppet could do nothing but suffer being forced open like an oyster. We decided it would be better for my puppet to continue the daily translations, my great-grandfather's book, line by line, first in Hindi, next in English, as you listened, rapt, and then repeated the line in Russian and French. Thus, the book's bones were broken. I didn't realize it until about a week before my audition, when I reread the book's last chapter, which I was yet to translate for you, and the bright words flew through my mind like comets. That feeling was gone from the other chapters. Somehow it had seeped out. And I told my glove puppet that it was not to say the final words of the book. The ghost approved, but she was also quite sure that you wouldn't choose me if my glove puppet didn't say the words we'd planned it would say. You and I. The ghost even advised me not to bother turning up. Naturally, I disregarded her advice. A couple of days later, the waiting room of your grand old school encased me in marbled fog as I watched other hopefuls practicing with their puppets. Some were more actors than puppeteers, but others handled their marottes and tickle puppets and bunroku puppets with an ease and affection that didn't exist between my glove puppet and me. I think the soul must be heavy and smooth manner. I deduce this from the buoyant, jerky movements of puppets, which lack souls. The girl beside me was very pretty. Tousled dreadlocks, dimples, and night sky skin. You know, with this radiance blended into the darkness. But I considered myself taken, and so I merely asked where her puppet was. "It's this." She took a small box out of her jacket pocket, and out of that box she took a porcelain chess piece, a plum-colored queen. Her only features, her crown, and a slight wave that conceded the existence of hips and a bosom. "Did you make it yourself?" "No, I found her. I know she doesn't look like a puppet, but she is one. I know it because when I first picked her up, I said something I'd never said before. I put her down, and then when I picked her up, I said the thing again, without meaning to. And again it was something I hadn't said before, even though the words were the same." "What's her routine?" "At the moment, she only asks this one question. But I'm hoping to learn how to get her to ask another." "What's her question?" The girl looked uncomfortable. She pointed at her name tag. "This is me, by the way. Taiki Shaw." My own name tag was lost in my hair, so I shook hands with her and said, "Radha Chaudhry, what's your puppet's question?" Taiki mumbled something, too low for me to hear. I'd just decided not to ask again. Maybe she was saving it up for the audition. When she repeated herself, "Is your blood as red as this?" A chess piece asking a personal question, possibly one of the most personal questions that could be asked. I didn't know how to answer. At my instruction, my glove puppet shook its head. "No. Surely your blood is redder." Taiki turned the purple queen around on her palm and asked the question again. This time the note of challenge left her voice, and the question became droll. The next time the chess piece asked her question, she sounded worried, seeking comparison for the sake of measuring normality. Frustration came next. After all, the chess piece wasn't even red, therefore as red as what? Compared to what? From what you'd said about Gustav Grimaldi's puppets, I knew you would strongly disapprove of the question Taiki Shaw's puppet asked. In fact, you would hate it. But this tiny queen's question was large. She spoke, and you couldn't think of anything else but her question and how to answer it. The sharpest thing I had on me was a brooch. I could prick my finger with my brooch pin, and then we would see. "You're good, Taiki," I said, and I wasn't the only one who walked out for fresh air. Several other demoralized applicants followed me out and had last-minute conversations with their puppets. "I'm not going to be able to get this job done for you," my own glove puppet said to me. "Shh, I won't let you pretend this is your fault," I told it. "I'm just going to have to find another way to show Myrna." There was a framed photograph hung on the wall in front of me, and when I said your name, I saw you in the picture. Well, I saw your back and your long, bright ponytail fluttering. The image is black and white, and you're running, and you cast a number of shadows that cluster about you like a bouquet. There's a figure running a little ahead of you, and at first the figure seems to be a shadow, too, except that it casts a backward glance that establishes an entirely separate personality. The figure's features are wooden, but mobile. Some sort of sprite moves within, not gently, but convulsively. A beauty that rattles you until you're in tears. That was my introduction to Rowan Wayland. You and the puppet, I decided it was a puppet, were leaping through one upright rectangle into another. An open door seen through an open door, and in the corner of that distant room was a cupboard fallen onto its side. There was a sign on the cupboard door. I tilted my head. The sign read, Toys. It's a photo in which lines abruptly draw back from each other, and ceilings and floors spin off in different directions. But for all that, the world that's pictured doesn't seem to be ending. You were both running in place. You blurred around the edges, the puppet hardly blurred at all, and the puppet was looking back, not at you, but at me. It felt like the two of you were running for your lives, for fear I'd take them. Or you could have been racing each other to the cupboard door, racing each other home. Toys, the sign reads. But signs aren't guarantees. Either way, I wanted to go too, and wish the puppet would hold out its hand to me, or beckon me, or do something more than return my gaze with that strange tolerance. When my name was called, I entered the audition room, and my glove puppet made an irresolute attempt to eat a sugar cube from a bowlful that had been left on a table, then gave in to despair and decided to sleep. After a minute, there was a crackling sound in the corner of the room, and I heard your voice through the speaker, Myrna, trying to give me a chance. "Miss Chaudhry, don't you have anything prepared? You've only got 10 more minutes, and as you may have seen in the waiting room, we're observing quite a few applicants today." This reminder had no effect on me. I continued as I was, until someone knocked on the audition room door, and then came in, glancing first at the clock, and then through the mirrored wall to the spot where I presumed you were sitting. It was a boy who came in. He had a hand behind his back, and I think I would have found that threatening if it weren't for his deep-set, elephantine eyes, the patience in them.
"I'm Gustav," he said. "Give me your puppet, and you shall have a different one."
"What will you do with mine?"
"It's up to him. He can sleep all he wants and have as much sugar as he likes, make new friends, maybe change the position of the parting in his hair if he's feeling daring. Quickly, take her."
I handed over my glove puppet and received a brass marionette in exchange.
"I got this one out of the store cupboard. She hasn't been out in a while. A lot of people find they can't work with her. She's haunted," Gustav said over his shoulder as he left the room. Smashing.
Orchestrating this new puppet's movement seemed hopeless. I was holding the wooden bar that controlled all her strings correctly, and none of the strings were tangled. But that had been Gustav's quick, deft work, not mine. Though we both stood still, I felt the marionette advance upon me, and without moving, I shrank away.
5 minutes, you said through the speaker, not hiding the note of incredulity in your voice.
I spoke to the puppet in the looking-glass English that my ghost friend speaks. I asked her if she was haunted or something worse. She answered eagerly, as you do in a foreign country when you need assistance and come upon someone who speaks your language.
"Worse, Thingsome," was her answer. "Worse, Thingsome. And if I help you now, you must help me later."
"You won't ask me to harm anyone?" I asked.
"Never."
"Then I accept."
"Good. Simply translate what I say. I will speak. Don't worry about the controls. I will match your posture. It'll look better."
She spoke the way that my ghost friend spoke. It cannot be that all ghosts speak the same way. I knew that even then. And I translated. It didn't take long.
"I am not a haunted puppet," we said. "I am living. My name is Geppetta, and a long time ago I was an apprentice to 2 puppeteers whose names are honored in this place. I took care of the puppets in the workshop. I was a kind of nurse to them, tending to their damage and making sure that they lasted. The masters grew old and died, and I stayed with the puppets. They were not living, but one step away from living, always one step away. They know when human life is near them, and they need human life to be near them. It keeps them from going wrong. I began to train others in the care of puppets. In my time, it seemed such knowledge was dying out. I trained a few boys and girls who wanted to learn, but a plague came. Not a plague that revealed itself in the skin. This one crept through the air. My apprentices died, and I would have two, but my puppet charges forbade it. Each puppet sacrificed something. A leg, an arm, torso, head, and so on. You will replace these things when you are ready, they said. They assembled a body, but didn't join up the parts. Look at your new body. You will go in, they said. I said I would not, but it happened hour by hour. I would drowse a little, and when I woke, another part of me had been replaced. It began with my left hand and ended with my right foot. Think of it, looking down at your human foot out of a pair of brass eyes. And then I grew smaller, and all of a piece, as I am today. My name is Chipetta. Long have I wanted to say this, but nobody would help me to say it. So, that was how I met my friend Chipetta. And as you know, Myrna Semyonova, 3 days later I was called back to your school, our school, and I found Taiki Shaw waiting for me. And you were there, and so was Gustav Grimaldi. Then I knew I'd been chosen, and I went to you. You smiled and said, "Well done." But it was Gustav who took my hand and said, "Welcome, brother. We'll do such things together." My ghost friend was right. I disobeyed you, and so you didn't choose me. But what were your reasons for choosing Taiki? I saw even then that you would try your best to break what she carries. "Why are you telling me all this again?" you say impatiently. But a person doesn't easily recover from the sadness of finding that it's not always affinity that draws us together. Not always, not only. That you can be called to undo the deeds of another. You make a lot of work for me. My blood runs cold to think of it all. But you see, I take strength from remembering that you began with intentions that were pure.
Is your blood as red as this? 2. Yes. Rada and Gustav had a shaky start. She brought me along to their first meeting, and the three of us walked around Berkeley Square. "Hi, Chipetta," Gustav said to me. He always says hello to me, even though I never reply. His good manners are his own affair. Rada threw breadcrumbs to pigeons. Gustav kept his sunglasses on the entire time and talked at length about the work of several mid-20th century filmmakers Rada had never heard of. I could see Rada making up her mind that if she was going to learn anything from Gustav, it would be by accident, and I saw her changing her mind when he introduced her to his puppets. "You've brought yours," he said to Rada, nodding in my direction, "and I've brought mine." 4 of them had accompanied him to this meeting, 2 peeping out from each of his coat pockets. They were good-natured fatalists, one and all, never in a rush, preferring to put off action until matters had resolved themselves without anyone in the troupe having had to lift a finger. The leader of the pack was a disheveled sophisticate named Hamlet. It was Hamlet who became Rada's chief extracurricular guide, her lecturer, heckler, cheerleader, and co-conspirator. At those times we all forgot whose voice and hands Hamlet and company were making use of, and the next day Rada would report mastery of some minor voice control trick to Gustav, as if he hadn't been there in the room with us. Initially it seemed that this type of forgetfulness seriously displeased Gustav, but as we grew more comfortable with him, I began to see that when Rada told him something odd or amusing that Hamlet or one of his other puppets had said or done, what Gustav actually expressed was restrained interest. He was observing a process we were not yet privy to. I caught on long before Rada did. She spoke to Gustav's troupe in a way that she would never have spoken to him directly. As this confidence flourished, so did a sympathy between Rada and Gustav's puppets, who devoted themselves to making her laugh and would materialize en masse outside her classroom door and walk her to the bus stop at the end of the day, crying, "Make way for boss lady!" Gustav surrounded her with her especial favorites, Hamlet with his pudding bowl haircut, Chagatai, who is both assassin and merman. He kills sailors with his sexy falsetto. Brunhild, the shipbuilder, and an astronaut named Petrushka, who answered any question put to him in exhaustive detail. Also present was a toddler-sized jumping bean known as Loco Dempsey. Their master walked behind Rada, arms raised as he worked the controls high above her head. Under Gustav's command, all the strings stayed separate. Rada marveled at that and leaned into him so as not to be the body that tangled those clean lines. He nudged a few of the controls into her hands, lowered his arm so that he was holding her, not tightly, since there's only so much you can do with your elbows. He whistled a brisk polonaise, and her gestures led his as she set Brunhild and Loco to marching. Rada looked so happy that I thought some kind of admission was forthcoming later, but instead she turned to me and said, "That can't be the same gang Myrna told me about." The night a fortune-teller outside KFC seized Rada by both hands and told her that little by little she was falling for an invisible man, she was confounded and kept me awake until dawn, asking who on earth it could possibly be. I couldn't decide whether the Grimaldi boy was to be pitied, congratulated, or scolded. Granted, this was one way to have a secret love affair, but there was no telling what his own feelings were, or whether this was just a routine seduction for him. Put yourself in his place. You're descended from generations of people who speak and have spoken primarily through puppets. As such, you're a kind of champion at psychological limbo, and you happen to like girls with brilliant eyes that see hidden things and dark hair from which they occasionally retrieve forgotten notes to themselves. Then you meet a new one. Wouldn't you try and see how close you could get without her noticing? Rada took to checking her phone constantly, but with no clear objective. Most of her messages were from Taiki Shaw, who she felt both jealous and protective of, and would have preferred not to have to deal with at all. Taiki was in the Orkney Isles with Myrna and her father, and in addition to relying on Rada to keep her updated on puppet school assignments, the girl insisted on being friendly and requesting personal news. Unaware that she had any, Rada settled for sending pictures of herself sitting on the curbstone outside her house, drinking homemade smoothies with her brother. I was in the photo, too, sat on Arjun's shoulders. I never spoke to him, and so he viewed me as a kind of fashion accessory of Rada's. At that time, I was getting some of my best fun from being alone with him and sporadically opening and closing my mouth whenever he blinked. Me, Geppetta, and AJ on the corner drinking heavy juice all day long. What about you and my wife? That was all the invitation Taiki needed to flood Rada's inbox with angst that Rada unintentionally increased by responding only with emoticons. Where do I begin? Well, everything I do pisses your wife off. I keep answering her rhetorical questions and then not daring to answer her non-rhetorical questions. Oh, and her specialty seems to be saying insanely awful stuff out of nowhere. The kind of things you have to forget in order to be able to go on living, you know? This one comment about my hands made me want to cut them off and just throw them away. Has anyone ever spoken to you like that? Never mind. I just avoid looking at my hands now. Ha ha ha, sob. Never been good at comebacks, so I just pick up rocks and pretend to clobber her when her back is turned. How's it going with Gustav, anyway? Rada, what exactly do you like about this wench? Her dad genuinely thinks she's human. For every 10 messages from Taiki, there were perhaps 3 or 4 from Myrna, all in praise of Taiki, and 1 from Gustav. One night, just as Rada had lain down on her bed, he sent a photo of his glove puppet, Chon Song Yi, wielding a tube of lipstick like a sword. Accompanying text, "Somebody stop her." As for Gustav, all that could be seen of him was a full, shapely lower lip stained orchid pink from Song Yi's lipstick attack. He was positioned behind the puppet, but it was one of those photos where the background very gradually becomes the foreground. At first glance, Rada snorted and rolled her eyes. Then she tilted her head, took another look, and slowly crossed and uncrossed her legs. Still studying the photo, she absent-mindedly traced the shape of her own mouth and sucked the tip of her index finger. The bedroom ghost and I looked at each other and silently agreed to vacate the room. I missed Desire, and I was glad my friend's heart had been given a puzzle to work on while it ached over Myrna Semyonova. Even if it became necessary to drop Gustav, Rada had other tutoring options. Her classmates were a friendly bunch, lacking in the competitive spirit their teachers would have liked to see. They worked on one another's ideas. Their puppets swapped costumes, props, catchphrases, and sometimes even characters. This kind of camaraderie made the ostracization of Rowan Wayland all the more marked. History of puppetry was the hour of the week in which Rada and the others played with paper, making puppets with pinned joints and hands and feet that spun like weather vanes. They were learning histories of Punchinello, a beak-nosed figure who stands for nothing. The place and century of his birth is the sort of thing learned people in tweed jackets argue about, but for a couple of centuries he's been present in Austria, where he is Kasperle, setting his cunning aside to concentrate on brutality without pause, until every other puppet in his world is dead, and then his master must see to it that he doesn't go after his audience, too. In Hungary, he's the terse and sardonic Vitéz László. In France, the twinkle returns to his eyes, and he becomes Polichinelle, a demon from the merriest of hells. In England, Punch is a sensitive chap. Any passerby who so much as looks at him the wrong way is promptly strangled with a string of sausages. When he takes up his Turkish residence, Karagöz is too lazy to attempt very much murder, though he has a reservoir of verbal abuse to shower upon anyone who comes between him and his meals. Wherever you find him, he is careful not to discuss the past. Whatever it is you're asking about, he didn't do it and hasn't the faintest idea who might be responsible. In fact, he doesn't know anything at all. He wasn't there, see? He's been here the whole time. Which begs the question, where were you? When Rada and I walked into the History of Puppetry classroom, the first thing we noticed was the ocean of space that surrounded Rowan Wayland, and for caution's sake we chose seats that maintained his solitude. We watched him, but had difficulty finding out whether keeping our distance was weak or wise. Nobody would talk about him. Wayland himself behaved as if his pariah status was perfectly natural, walking around the building looking straight ahead with his collar popped up around his ears. Rada remarked that he gave her the strange feeling of being an extra on a film set. It took 2 weeks for curiosity to change our seating vote. "Maybe he's just misunderstood," I said. Rada agreed to risk it. He had a pair of red needles and a heap of wool on top of his books and was knitting while he waited for the teacher to arrive. There's a gentle assurance many knitters have as they fix their patterns in place. Rowan's knitting wasn't like that. He stared at his sock in progress with an insistence that brooked no compromise, as if he'd learned that this was the only way to ensure that each stitch stayed where he'd put it. We took the seats alongside him. Rada said hello, and kept saying it until he acknowledged her with a sidelong glance. "I'm Rada," Rada said, before he could look away again. "Okay," he said. "Why?" I mean, what do you want? Nothing, Radha answered, with the guileless good cheer that makes her so dear to me. Just saying hello.